coming up on Path to Zero.
Science is very important. It's the basis of everything we do, but it's a human story, right? Climate change is ultimately a human story.
Welcome to a special edition of Path to Zero, recorded from the Reuters Global Energy Transition Summit in New York City. Now, here's your host, Tucker Perkins.
You've tuned in to what is sure to be an interesting episode of Path to Zero. While we're here in New York, we're fortunate to speak to the journalist who is leading global climate coverage for one of the largest news organizations in the world. Peter Pringleman is the Global Climate and Environmental News Director for the Associated Press, the not-for-profit news agency headquartered here in New York. The AP was founded in 1846 and has earned 59 Pulitzer Prizes over the years. Peter, we're so honored to have you here in New York City. Welcome to Path to Zero.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's going to be a fascinating conversation, and you've had a fascinating career, so it should be. You've covered stories in 15 different countries, I believe. I know you had a long career in the bureau there in Rio de Janeiro. Stanford, several books about Brazil. He's got so much to tell us about, but kind of tell us about maybe your journey, and then more specifically, your journey inside Associated Press covering these stories.
My journey, well, I'd start a little bit with Brazil. That kind of leads into the books and, you know, Brazil and covering the Associated Press. So when I was 10 years old, my mom adopted two boys from Brazil. And that was the first time I went to Brazil twice in Recife in the north. And so it sort of planted a seed in me in the interest in Latin America and specifically the interest in Brazil, which would then, you know, manifest itself years later when I studied Portuguese and I did a master's at Stanford based on Brazil, and then would work in Brazil for 3 years and write a couple of books. And then with the Associated Press, I just always had this dream when I was growing up. I liked to write, and I wanted to work as a foreign correspondent. I really didn't know what that meant at the time, you know, when I was in high school and then in college. But when I graduated from college, I went about figuring out what that was, and have now worked with AP for 22 years, many of those years overseas, many of those years also in the U.S. in a lot of different roles. Currently, I oversee our climate and environment team around the world, and so we are covering stories on climate change, which is a huge subject.
It is a huge subject, and we're going to talk about it a little bit more, but such a different subject and story in Africa or Brazil. In fact, Brazil and South America is almost largely, I think, absent from the conversation sometimes, other than the role of sugarcane and ethanol. So I love talking about it. But it's just so different as you go around the world, not only the evolutions, but the way the citizens perceive it. So we're going to talk about that. But first, talk about your team. I mean, how difficult is it to have this team across the country and reporting accurately?
It's a challenge. We have 30 people around the world, which sounds like a lot, but and is a good sizable team. But for the enormity of the story, it's not that large, right? Every day there are extreme weather events happening around the world, and this is one of the ways that our team covers climate change. We also cover policy changes, which is, you know, really important. We cover solutions. We look at, you know, different green energies, things that people are trying to do to decarbonize the world. And we really try to tell human stories more than anything. I think if there was any air of climate journalism, you know, in the past, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it was too focused on the science. And I think a lot of journalists and a lot of readers thought you have to know a lot about science to care about this story. That's not the case. Science is very important. It's the basis of everything we do, but it's a human story, right? Climate change is ultimately a human story.
And as you think about that, it is a human story. Is there a particular scene or event that struck you at the time that said, this isn't about science, this is about people?
Oh, there's so many. I think a couple in the last years, the flooding in Pakistan a couple of years ago where a third of the country was underwater. Libya had some really devastating floods last summer that killed thousands of people. Those are a couple that definitely stick with me. But you know, through the stories, we focus on humans and people, particularly people who've been forced to move because of extreme weather. And so many of those stories stick with me. Climate change is an inequality story at the end of the day, right? If you have the money and you live in a coastal area, you can just build your house a little bit higher on stilts, or you can move somewhere else. If you don't, you're stuck.
Right.
You know, you may be forced to leave. You may not have a place to go. We've done stories on people who live amid several inches of water every day in their house because they don't have anywhere else to go.
How hard is it to tell the story, you know, in a way that's fair to the story, fair to the facts, fair to the emotion? I mean, I can only imagine how difficult it is, but talk to us. AP is very well known for being fact-based. But how hard is it to tell the true story?
I don't think it's hard to tell the true story. I think the challenge comes more in getting stories to resonate. And, you know, because we're at such a busy news time, if you think just the last couple of years, we have the war in Ukraine, we have the war in Gaza, we have elections all over the world. We have, you know, former President Trump in and out of court and this election going on. There's so many things that I think it's hard to get readers' attention a lot of times.
Does resonate mean that they read it, or does resonate mean that they read it and then perhaps act on it?
I'd say read it, because I think AP is very careful and my team is very careful about not going into advocacy, or I mean, that it's not our job to tell people what to do in any shape or form. It is our job to inform them of what's happening in the world, what's happening to the earth, and what are some of the solutions that can counter climate change. What they do with it is up to them.
You've written several books. We're going to talk about it. Kind of excited about both of them, really, because your books really are about Brazil, right? I think, well, fascinating. Large country, 200 million people, if people don't realize that. The Amazon rainforest is mainly in Brazil and certainly kind of the center, I think, of the whole debate in a lot of respects. Talk about how Brazil views climate change, public policy, the role of government. I mean, and at the end of the day, is Brazil making progress?
So it depends. It depends who you ask. That's a tough question. The current president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, he is a champion of the environment. I think that's a fair statement. He's also very practical. And so while some of his policies, like cutting deforestation, really do protect the Amazon, some of his other policies, like continuing oil drilling, because Brazil is a major oil country, those things go against some of those policies. And so I think, you know, Lula is somebody who is trying to thread a very difficult needle. When it comes to the Amazon, you know, Brazilians are proud of it. They are interested in it. I also think there's a strong national feeling of, don't tell us what to do.
Right.
You know, that's a very strong in Brazil. Even if you are, you know, an environmentalist, you often don't want to hear from other countries saying, well, this is how you should maintain your forests, because Brazilians make the point, well, the Europeans and Americans, you know, they cut a lot of their forests historically.
Right.
So who are you to tell us, you know, what is going on? So,
and at the end of the day, for many of them, that deforestation is really the difference between living, not living, living well, perhaps, eating and not eating, right? I mean, again, it's at a policy level that's up, but when you finally get down to it, for many of the farmers, it's the difference between having money or not having money.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the forest is a living thing. You have, you know, all kinds of tribes, even some uncontacted tribes, which is kind of incredible if you think about in 2024. And then you have lots of people who live and depend, who are not indigenous, but live and depend on the forest in different ways, and cut it, you know, to sell the wood, to raise cattle, to do a lot of different things that do produce jobs. I would argue, though, that there is increasing bioeconomy of jobs and things that people can do to maintain the forest and still find livelihood. And we write about some of those things.
Let's talk about your books. Dilma's Downfall, right? Is that your first book?
That's the first one, yeah.
The first book. Yeah, it's about Brazil's first first woman president, and then her ultimate impeachment. What about that story inspired you to write a book?
So I wrote this book with colleague and friend Mauricio Savarese, and I think what really inspired both of us was watching the 2016 impeachment, because here was a president, Dilma Rousseff, who had been elected twice, right? Who really hadn't done anything wrong in terms of the law. There were these kind of cooked up charges against her for what they called fiscal maneuvering, moving things from one budget to the next. But they were very weak. But here is this democratically elected president who was pushed out of office because of these things, but they weren't really because of those things. It was more that she had lost the room as a political leader in some ways, and there were all kinds of other things that came into it. And I think she faced a level of sexism that, you know, no male president had ever faced. And we wrote about this. There were forces definitely from the hard right that were out to get her. There were a lot of things. Her own vice president orchestrated much of the coup against her. So there were a lot of things against her, but ultimately it was a political move to push her out, and she had kind of lost the room. And so I think Mauricio and I were both really struck by that something like that could happen at the time in 2016 for a young democracy like Brazil that had a history of a military dictatorship and, you know, hadn't been out of that for that long. So I think that was the original inspiration, is like, dig into it, see what happened, and recount this.
Well, you certainly made a major step from the first story about politics and the power of politics and all of that. Your next story was about a person who had no power whatsoever, an 8-year-old boy wandering the streets of Rio who was determined to help others. I think that book, One for Two.
One for Two. Yeah, it's a children's book.
Is it a children's book?
Well, I don't know. What do you think? I wrote it.
I think the story is powerful for adults.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I was inspired actually by my son. I have three boys who was really taken in the years that we lived in Brazil with all the homelessness and all the poverty that he saw every day, and in his own small way, like he wanted to counteract some of this, and so that's what I wrote about. Basically, this young boy, loosely based on him, that was going out into the street, seeing all this poverty, and just thinking, can I give them something? You know, will that help? And then through it all, you know, the story talks about the homelessness, the militias, the violence, the stuff that's on the street. So yeah, you're right. Maybe it's not a happy children's book,
but it's a meaningful story, and I'm really glad you told it.
Thank you.
So now, are you working on a third book?
I am, actually. Yeah, I'm working on another children's book based on communication. So I have three sons. And my third son, the youngest, named Pablo, has Down syndrome, and he doesn't speak. But he communicates amazingly with gestures and grunts and pointing people, and he has this language device. And so all of this comes together for this kind of pretty amazing communication. And so I'm going to write, I'm working on a book about how people who can't speak basically can find ways to communicate based on him.
It's wonderful. Everyone has a voice. It's just how they use it. We'll look forward to seeing that. Let's kind of, while we're thinking about Brazil and homelessness and powerless people, I hate to use that word because I'm not sure that's exactly right, and we come back to the energy transition, what we tend to see, how does that intersect mainly in your world for the powerless, the homeless, perhaps the people who are working minimum wage jobs? How are they impacted?
It's a good question. There's a lot of talk around energy transition in trying to make a just transition, what they talk about, right, a just transition, so that we don't repeat some of the mistakes of the past. And some of the mistakes of the past, I think, particularly with fossil fuels, have been, like oil, putting oil close to people where people could get sick, right? That's one of the things of the past. And so there's a lot more conversation now in green energy about being conscious of those things. If you're putting up a solar farm, if you're doing a carbon capture plant, which, you know, has gas, it's still CO2, can be dangerous, can, you know, be bad for people to breathe. Like that conversation is much more front and center than I think it certainly would have been 20 or 30 years ago. So I think that's one way that people intersect. There's also, I think, a hope that green energy transition can lead to many more jobs, can lead to many more trades kind of jobs where, you know, you don't have to have a college education. You don't have to have the money to go to a really expensive place. You can learn trades that can lead to a good living. So I think, you know, for working class people, that's part of the conversation as well.
Good. Let me ask you one question, and I'll try to sidestep, because I don't mean to imply politics, and it may be too personal, but we'll see how it goes. One of the things I think that troubles me is I think specifically about the U.S. transformation, where the government is deploying grand sums of money. I often worry about the impact on society from where we're not spending. Should we be spending more time? Perfect example today is we have more shootings, this or that, tragedies. Are we spending enough on mental health? Are we spending enough on medicine and housing and true infrastructure? Do you ever think about that as you kind of cover this? And we now talk about trillions almost nonchalantly into the energy mix. Do you ever worry about perhaps underspending in true society's needs?
I do. I think it's a really good question. Everything that you spend on is something else that you're not spending on, right? And if you're the government, you have to weigh all of those things. So it's definitely something that I think about. I think it's something that, you know, AP journalists think about as we cover these stories of, like, how much is dedicated to this versus how much is dedicated to that. All that said, I think climate change is a major threat for humanity. And so many of the things that you mentioned, education, you know, health, equality, inequality, those things intersect with climate change. So I'm not saying that climate change is, you know, spending money on addressing climate change or energy transition is more important than anything else, because there are lots of important things. But if you don't address climate change, all those other things are going to be exacerbated. And we're already seeing that in many ways.
Great answer. Thank you. COP27. You were there. It's nice. You not only were there, you hosted a panel.
I was, yeah. I was there, and I was at COP28 as well, and we have COP29 coming up in Azerbaijan.
Will you be there also?
I will. Yeah.
So at COP27, you hosted a really important panel, I think, and talked about how the war in Ukraine was impacting the energy transition. Talk to us about that whole panel.
So, yeah, the panel had, you know, several energy experts, somebody from at the time who was part of the Biden administration, and the general thought, the general, you know, discussion was, how has the war in Ukraine impacted energy transition? And I think at that time, you know, it was very kind of recent, and so we didn't have as much information then as we do now about how much the war in Ukraine has impacted energy transition. But I think today we can really speak to it because so many different things have happened. You have places like Germany that, you know, really doubled down on moving away from nuclear, trying to move away from coal. Some of that hasn't worked as well. You have in the U.S. and other countries a build out of liquid natural gas. I think that's partially a result of a feeling of we need more energy security. So while, you know, the International Energy Agency says we can't have more fossil fuel infrastructure, we shouldn't be drilling more, we shouldn't be having ports for liquid natural gas, governments are starting to say, well, actually, no, we need more of this for energy security. I think the war in Ukraine has really changed the conversation and brought it much more to what you were talking about a little while ago, and that's the trade-offs of what you spend on and what you don't. I think it's forced those conversations in really interesting ways. But every country, you know, has been a little bit different in how they've approached this. I think, you know, there are some countries, particularly in Europe, that have said, look, this is why we can't be dependent on fossil fuels. If we can really up our solar and wind power, then we don't depend on somebody like Putin. But other countries said, actually, we need to continue with this technology. We need to continue with oil.
Yeah, interesting. The whole evolution of that Russian energy space into Europe and kind of the impact the invasion had, it still continues to roil the energy. I mean, just this week, we're still trying to redirect LNG flows. Fascinating.
Yeah. No, it is. It is. And this is something we're looking at on my team. One of my colleagues, Ed Davey, has written about the LNG buildup in the Philippines, particularly. They're pushing to become kind of the hub for Asia. And so we're looking at that and, like, you know, why are they doing that? Who's benefiting? You know, all of those things. It's part of the kind of the accountability journalism we do.
And I know you see it because you report on it every day and you're thinking about it all day, every day. But it also, energy ultimately becomes power, right? Maybe power and energy are inseparably linked. But now we see, to a degree, Russia, North Korea, certainly China, becoming some kind of a power for energy, for users of energy. India kind of in or out, depending on sometimes economics. So it's fascinating. I think we'll still be unwinding decades from now, I think. On that,
I think so too, and I think energy and power are intimately linked, particularly, you know, in 2024, to shut off the lights. I mean, that's not the way that we live. So, he who has the energy or she who has the energy has the power in many ways.
For you, who have such a worldwide view, and your team sends you their views often, anywhere that's particularly inspiring to see something going on in the world that tells you this is hopeful, and yes, we're going to find net zero, and we're going to find it by 2050. Anywhere particularly inspiring?
I would say two places, two large areas. I find Africa very inspiring. Some of the best ideas for energy transition are coming out of Africa. There are all kinds of tech startups that are doing great things. What Africa needs is much more investment. I think that's, but the ideas are there, the people are there, the human capital are there, the people who know intimately what it is to live climate change are there, because so many are on the front line. So I think Africa really inspires a lot of hope for me in many ways in the stories that we do. And then I would say the U.S. I mean, not to, you know, tout the U.S. because I'm American, but when you look at the Inflation Reduction Act, Biden's big climate law, It really is changing a lot of America, of jobs being rolled out, of people taking advantage of tax credits for efficiencies in their homes, for electric cars. I mean, that legislation, it'll take some years to know, you know, how impactful, but it's having an impact. So when you step back and you say, well, where are some hopeful things? I think that's an area.
Yeah, interesting. Very few other countries have followed Biden and with kind of massive scale programs like Inflation Reduction Act. I keep waiting to see other countries, and I'm not sure why, but most of them aren't following that with massive scale investment.
I think it just depends on how you invest, because China, for example, they don't have a similar law, but their policies are around energy transition. Of course, they're around coal and meeting their own energy needs and stuff too. But China, for example, is the number one producer of solar panels in the world. So, but China is a government that can just decide to do things, whereas in the U.S., not so much, right? And so I think Biden's calculation with that was, all right, I'm just going to provide carrots. If you look at the IRA, there are no sticks. It's just carrots. If you do good things for the climate, you get some benefits. If not, well, you know. So I think it's just the method that you do it.
Yes, it's we just appreciate your reporting on it, because I think most of us don't have visibility into Europe or Africa or Asia, and a lot going on. So we appreciate your reporting on that. All right, time for some fun.
Okay.
Maybe to me the most difficult question I'll ask you. I'm going to hand you a magic wand, and you can use that wand one time for one thing in the next year that you think would have the biggest impact on climate change, how would you use it?
I think I would, on climate change or just the world?
Well, I'll give you the world.
Okay, let me do the world. There's a lot with climate change, but I think this would help the world. I would wave the wand and have people remember their history. Like, take into account history. Because I feel like humans, and I see this with my kids, right? You see teenagers having to live all these things that you had to live, right? And you have to go through them. Part of that's part of life. But historically, as countries, it seems like, you know, we fight a lot of the same wars over and over for similar things. We treat each other, you know, badly in the same ways as humans. It's like so many of these things repeat themselves. So if I could wave a wand, it would be that the history that we all learn in school, like, it sinks in and we say, wait a second, we've been down that road, right? We fought wars in Europe. Do we have to have another one? You know, we fought wars in the Middle East, you know, and I'm not making any opinions on what should happen or not, but just that war is not good, right? So that's what I would do.
So not only know about your past, but hopefully learn from your past.
Learn from your past. Implement it.
Okay, now I'm going to tighten you up a little bit. Now let's go use that wand for climate change. How would you use it?
I think I would use it to somehow get stories about climate change in front of the public in a way that just hasn't been done. Because I believe that when you know more about what's happening to the earth and you know more about the options that we have to confront some of these problems, you'll feel propelled to act. You know, it's not on me or my team or journalism to say this is what you should do, but we do want people to be conscious. And I feel like between all the news that there is out there, between a lot of misinformation, between a lot of confusion, the impact of what's happening to the climate isn't really felt on a large scale. So that's what I would wave a wand for, because I think a lot of things would follow from that.
You're a guest 105, I think. I've asked that question 105 times. I was hoping that would be your answer. And I'm wrong 99% of the time, but I completely agree with you that it's not only about educating and focus, to your point, take the time to read the story that we took the time to write, but think about it and then perhaps think about how to use it in your life.
That's right.
A great use of your wand in both choices.
Well, thank you.
So thank you very much. Our second fun tradition is to plant a tree in your honor, the time you spend with us, the expertise you share with us. We love to find a national forest in the United States. You live now in New York. I know you lived in Arizona. I'm sure you lived a few other places. Where is a forest that you would love us to plant a tree in your name?
I would say the Coconino Forest in Arizona. I lived in Arizona for 4 years in Phoenix. To get to the forest, you have to drive north to Flagstaff. There are many beautiful forests around the world. I've had the honor to see many, including the Amazon. But that one really sticks with me. And I think because of the smells, the smells of the pine trees in the high desert, whether it's winter or summer, those smells are just amazing. They take you somewhere.
Awesome. We will look forward to that. Great, great use of that choice as well.
Thank you.
Before we let you go, anything you want to tell our listeners about something you're working on personally, something the Associated Press is working on, or perhaps how to learn a little bit more about you and your stories?
I'll mention two things that our team is working on. We are getting ready to launch a series looking at indigenous peoples around the world, how they're adapting to climate change, and in some cases, how they're combating climate change. That's one series. And then we're also getting ready to launch a series looking at the transition to green energy and specific workers. Like, just, I really like deep stories on individuals, and these are people who used to work in, you know, fossil fuel industries and have now worked, you know, moved to green energy. And so we explore their jobs and their thinking and stuff. So I'm excited about both of those.
Well, we will look forward to both of those. Peter, it's been so nice to have you. Congratulations on your two books, One for Two, so exciting. We look forward to your third book and for the work that you lead with your team at Associated Press. Thank you. Thanks for being on Path to Zero.
Thanks for having me. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to a special edition of Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.